two new short story collections that illuminate society as well as characters.
My method, for whatever reason, is to make a kind of a difficult situation or a situation where somebody gets tested morally and then kind of turn up the heat and basically almost like a lab experiment, you know, trying to see how people behave under duress.
That's George Saunders. Drew Adamek talks to him about his acclaimed new collection, 10th of December. And Jennifer Haig revisits some old territory.
One thing that has really fascinated me in the past few years as I've traveled around the country talking about Baker Towers is how universal this story appears to be. When I first wrote that novel and later these stories in News from Heaven, I sort of expected that they would be viewed as regional stories, you know, possibly of interest to people in the Rust Belt, but maybe not much of anywhere else. And after Baker Towers was published, I was pleased to discover that readers all over the country seemed to find something familiar in this experience.
We talk with her about her fictional town, Bakerton, Pennsylvania, and the changes its people have gone through over the past near century. Her new story collection is News from Heaven. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Drew Adamek is next in conversation with George Saunders.
George Saunders is a giant of American fiction. Last month, the New York Times called him the writer for our times. He's a MacArthur Fellow, he's won the National Magazine Award for Fiction 4 times, and his work is widely anthologized. His work is so original, is such a masterful blending of genres, and written with such skill that it defies easy explanation. He expertly captures the cadences and nuances of language to create characters that repel and attract in equal measure. He combines shock and dismay with wit and sensitivity and a pitch-perfect voice with an unbelievably deft touch. It is almost impossible to read a George Saunders story without being moved. The bulk of Saunders' writing takes the short story form, although he has also published a novella called The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, a children's book called The Very Persistent Gippers of Fripp, and a collection of essays called The Braindead Megaphone. His new book, 10th of December, is his 4th collection of short stories. Called the best book you'll read this year, this deeply moving, yet nervously dark, collection of 10 stories, most of which first appeared in The New Yorker, is a wide-ranging indictment of our consumer culture and a chronicle of disconnected loneliness filled with unforgettable and expertly drawn characters. The stories in 10th of December range from Victory Lap, in which a pair of socially disparate teenagers confront a sudden act of violence, to Home, in which a soldier who committed war crimes in Iraq and is suffering from PTSD returns home to find that his domestic situation pushes him to the brink, to the title story, in which a misfit 10-year-old boy and an older man dying of cancer face their deaths together in a frozen forest preserve. I recently spoke to Mr. Saunders about his new collection, why the short story is such a powerful storytelling tool for him, and the futility of talking about writing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, will you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this collection, 10th of December, and how the stories that were selected were included in this book?
Sure. I mean, you know, my books, this is my 4th collection, and they've all kind of been written the same way, which is I kind of just, you know, start. I just start writing one story, and then that story usually raises some questions or kind of burns me out on a certain stylistic approach and produces another one and so on. So then at the end of a certain period, I start to feel like it's almost a collection. In this case, it was 6 or 7 years. Then you just kind of, you know, wait for the last word to be finished. And then there's a kind of an intense period of ordering and reordering and cutting some out and that kind of thing. But I kind of just feel my way towards what constitutes a collection. I don't have a big, you know, plan at the beginning or any kind of outline or anything like that. Very intuitive.
And how would you describe the stories themselves for a listener or a reader who's not familiar with your work, the 10 stories that are included in this collection?
Well, I would describe them as great. You have to buy them. No, I would say...
Award-winning.
Award-winning, yes, addictive. No, they're kind of dark, actually. You know, they're my method, for whatever reason, is to make a kind of a difficult situation or a situation where somebody gets tested morally, and then kind of turn up the heat and basically almost like a lab experiment, you know, trying to see how people behave under duress. So I think for a kind of new reader, someone new to my work, they would strike you as being pretty severe, I guess, in some ways. But also they're ostensibly funny. And I hope their reader would feel kind of a loving presence behind all of it, kind of stage managing it. And I mean, it's a hard thing. I'm not real articulate about what the stories do, but I kind of know it when I feel it. Like as I'm working on them, I kind of feel pretty close to them and pretty in control. And then I step back and I'm not sure what to say about them, really.
This is your fourth collection of short stories, and you've also published a nonfiction collection and a children's book and a novella. And no novels. What is it about the short story form that's so powerful and so necessary for you?
You know, the honest answer is I have strong opinions about short form stuff. If I'm writing something that's, you know, 8 pages, I have a very strong idea of what needs to be done. But when I push off into these longer forms that are 70, 80, 90, 100, 200 pages, it's not like I get lost, but I just kind of lose my opinion about them. You know, it's almost like I can see short form things very clearly, and I'm decisive about them, but when it gets past a certain length, I kind of lose my aesthetic compass a little bit. So I've had a couple of things that were long, and I just said, you know, that's actually not meant to be that long, and I cut it back. So the analogy I sometimes use is it might be a little bit like you know, they describe athletes as having fast or slow twitch muscles, and I think I just have in my aesthetic muscle in writing is kind of fast twitch for whatever reason.
As a reader of this collection, I really got the sense that a lot of these stories, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I took away from this with these stories were about half of them were about language and the inability of our modern language and our modern culture to communicate and connect effectively. Is that something that you've put into these stories, and is that something that you've considered as you were writing them?
I think it's a good reading of them, but my experience is that language is kind of the way I navigate through a story. It's the way I keep my own interest up. So if, for example, if I'm writing in a certain diction and it starts to bore me, I'll always find some way to get out of that diction and into another one. So I think you're absolutely right as a sort of critical analysis. In the actual execution, it tends to be a little more pragmatic and a little more seat of the pants. You know, you feel like, God, I'm tired of writing this voice. Let me swerve over here. Or, for example, there's a story in the book called Escape from Spiderhead where, you know, one of the risks is that there's a drug that you take and it makes you more articulate. And that just came out of the fact that I'd written 3 or 4 stories in kind of a low-key, almost minimalist fiction, and I was just kind of tired of it. So at some point I thought, man, I really want to write in a higher register. So then the drug just becomes kind of a trick, really, a vehicle, you know, to get you to do this. So I think in the execution, I'm not thinking that overtly about the issues that you're mentioning, but I think what you're saying is completely valid nonetheless.
And that's something that really strikes me about this collection, not just this collection, but your writing in general, is your ability to tap into different dictions. And there's, for example, the story Victory Lap. You write from 3 very different voices, and yet you capture them, in my mind, so perfectly. I mean, they're just pitch perfect. How do you open yourself up and find those disparate voices and make them so clear?
Well, that's a great question. The closest I could come to being truthful is that I try to approach it in a spirit of fun. In other words, to try to find, kind of look around and see what voice would be fun at the moment, meaning what voice is kind of full in me at that moment. And then kind of allow myself to play. There's a lot of drafting in those, you know, like kind of false starts and revisions and so on. So I think probably the truth is it's sort of a natural ability. Like when I was a kid, I used to do that. We'd make up characters and different voices and even different backstories and stuff. So it's kind of just enjoyable, really. You know, I know for me, I had a big breakthrough when I was about 30, where I went from thinking that writing was sort of this laborious, careful, intellectual thing to sort of remembering that it could also be an entertainment, both for reader and writer. It could be a sort of joy. So those voices are just really fun. You know, I kind of just, And, of course, part of the exercise, too, is to say, okay, I've made a 15-year-old girl. Now I'm making a 15-year-old boy, and I have to distinguish him from her so they don't run into each other. Then it just becomes a bit of strategy, like, well, she has this turn of phrase. She has to have a different one. She has this psychology. He has to be distinguishable. So when I'm not able to do voices is when I'm trying to stage manage it too much and make the voices functional, you know, make them sort of serve the story. But when it does work is when I can say, oh, the hell with it, and just start riffing, you know. Then a character will appear, and often a character wants something or does something that actually causes plot to happen. And that's a really, you know, when that happens, I'm always glad about it, because that's sort of a natural progression.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Today, I'm talking to writer George Saunders about his new story collection, 10th of December. You mentioned fun, and a lot of the writing about your work mentions humor, and mentions, in some ways, satire. But I find, in my reading of this, a lot of these stories, about half of these stories, I find a real sadness in that. And how do you balance that, and what's the approach to balancing the sadness and the humor?
Well, I think they're so closely related, don't you? I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I got really sad. I would kind of rev myself up by trying to make somebody laugh. Or often, you know, when you're in a state of happiness, you're kind of aware that it won't last. And so I think maybe for me, one of the tricks is to not think of those things as diametrically opposed. You know, I mean, obviously there is such a thing as happiness, and there's sadness, and there's tragedy. But somehow I think if you disable that binary a little bit as you're working, then it's more kind of like you're doing minute to minute whatever you need to do to keep the reader's interest. So this is sort of a crude way of saying it, but let's say that I've gotten on two really funny riffs in a row, and I know the reader's laughing. Well, in a way, that's kind of like she's a little bit vulnerable now for me to slip in something a little more dark or serious. Then when you do that, the whole story hops up a level. Suddenly it's a funny story that's about something serious. Or conversely, if you just put something really dark and hard to process in there, something dangerous, you can destabilize the story by then leaning on that in a slightly funny way. So it's a little bit like riding a bike. You know, how do you decide to lean left or right? Well, the first thing is to be really aware of where you are in relation to your reader, and then do the intuitive thing, you know. So it's, you know, in a funny way, the answer is you do it line by line. You sort of see where you are and then adjust accordingly, if that makes sense.
It does, and that brings me back to something that I wanted to ask about as far as intentionality in some of these stories, and something that you had mentioned earlier about creating sort of difficult or dark situations. And again, in my reading, and I'm sure other people take other things away from this, is these are characters, particularly like the story Al Roston or Escape from Spiderhead, these are characters that have been assigned roles, either by their circumstances or their biology, that they're trying to break out. And it's really about trying to break out of the roles that we have been assigned. Is that something that you set out to address?
No, but when you say that really resonates with me, and it makes sense. I think, you know, only because as you were saying that, I thought, oh, I never thought of it that way. And isn't that kind of true of all of us? I mean, you know, I think you start out on life and you are trapped a little bit by your neurology, by your habits, by your biology, maybe by your class and your culture or whatever. And I think you can see life as kind of a long process of trying to get free of certain things and relax into others. And even if you want to go deeper than that, I would argue that we're born a little bit screwed up. Maybe this is original sin, and that we're born thinking, one, that we're central to everything. The world wasn't here until we were. Second, that we're permanent. You know, we're going to be here forever. And third, that our narrative is the central narrative. Like, you know, we're what it's all about. And then, you know, as you get older, you gradually, hopefully, anyway, you work your way out of that trap. You know, you realize, oh, actually, I'm not going to be here forever. I'm not central, and the world, you know, was going before I got here, and will continue afterwards. So, at least my experience of life has been trying to make that accommodation in a way that didn't fill you with despair, that correctly oriented you to the rest of the world. So I think in like Al Roston the Spiderhead, you get people with exaggerated cases of that, just as you put it. You know, they're in a situation where they're under extreme constraint. Their cell foot is somehow flailing there at the bottom of this deep well, and it wants to get out. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I can't say that I intended it, but as I said, you know, I don't think, for me, intentionality is something I really try to suspend till the very end of the story, or only apply it in the smallest possible way. Like, okay, this guy is doing this action. Do I prefer him to do action A or action B? But the big sort of thematic intentionality, I just found earlier that if I do that, it trips me up. The stories end up being too reductive. So I try to trick myself and not have that intentionality get into it if I can do it. You know, I think your reading is absolutely correct, but for me, I don't get to a point where a reader can analyze a story unless I suspend intentionality as long as I can.
I'm Drew Adamek, and this is Writer's Voice, and I am talking to George Saunders, author of the new story collection, 10th of December. Back to that idea, though, in a story like Home, which is so powerful and yet political at the same time, it's a powerful narrative and a powerful story, but also deeply political. Is that something that happens then on accident, or do you see a headline, or do you say, boy, this Iraq war really irks me, or PTSD really irks me? And I want to write about that. And for people who have not read the story, it's the story of a young soldier who comes home who may or may not have committed atrocities overseas and finds that the dysfunction at home sets him up to react, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, you did. I think for me, you know, the best description I can give is you kind of just you get close to a thing and you can feel that there's going to be energy there. And at that point, you approach very respectfully and you say, I don't know what exactly you're trying to tell me, but I can feel that there's some potential here. So in that case, it was just years ago I read Heracles, that play by Euripides, and it was right at the beginning of the Iraq War, and I thought, oh, that's an incredible parable for war, you know, for a guy coming home from war. And then in the intervening years, I kept saying, oh, yeah, I should try to do a version of that updated. And in that time, I sort of forgot the story and kind of messed it up in my mind. So I just one night I was just thinking, yeah, I've got nothing to do. Let's try that war story, and kind of just started kind of reconstructing what I could remember of Heracles. And, you know, I'm a left-wing guy, and I was not crazy about that war. But at the same time, what happens is as you're working on a story, it becomes less about an issue. It has to become less about an issue and more about the actual individual that you made. So what might start out to be vaguely political quickly under the discipline of revision becomes more and more and more about a specific individual. And my contention would be that that's really the only way a story can work, is to be about an individual that you've created. And the story has to be respectful of what you've made. So in a certain way, it feels political, but I think it's a bit like a story that tries to be political is a little bit like a hammer made out of jello. Logically, it can't be political because you're the puppeteer, you know. But in the best case, a story about a political issue reminds us that there aren't political issues. There are only personal issues. You know, personal issues writ large would be political. So on that one, I hope that you feel sympathy for the guy, and I hope you also feel a little surprised that you're feeling sympathy for a guy who, in my mind, did commit atrocities. And then if that happens, you're in that wonderfully complicated space where you have to suspend judgment, which to me is kind of a holy place to be, if only for a couple of minutes a day.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. You come from, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, you come from a very sort of blue-collar background. I shouldn't say very, but you come from a blue-collar background without all the sort of educational bells and whistles in the beginning that we're told that a writer needs to have now. How does that influence your writing and influence your approach to writing, or am I completely misreading that and way off base?
No, I mean, I don't know if it was, I don't know if I'd call it blue collar. It's kind of hard to, it was the south side of Chicago and kind of a really interesting suburban neighborhood that we had cement contractors, and my dad was a salesman who became the vice president of this coal company, and we had somebody who was an accountant for Wrigley. So I'm not quite sure how to characterize that neighborhood. But in my 20s, especially, I kind of, after college, I kind of fell off the wagon and ended up being working all these kind of weird jobs and got some insights into, you know, kind of what it's like to be not affluent, I guess, you know, you could say. And I was an engineer. I went to college for geophysical engineering. So I think that, I mean, really the short story would be that it just got me into a lot of situations that I wouldn't have been in otherwise, you know, both being broke, working, like I worked at the slaughterhouse for a while, I worked as a roofer. So I think that was all just kind of good grist for the mill to sort of know different sides of America so that when you go to invent something, you kind of feel like you have some authority. You know, I feel like if I want to write about what it's like to be down on your luck, I kind of know that, you know. And conversely, you know, I've been lucky since to sort of get to travel in higher circles and do different things that taught me a little bit more about the, you know, the higher reaches of America. So I think part of your job as a writer is to just get a real intuitive sense of what your country is like and what the range of possibilities is. So then when you go to make something up, you're not just, well, in a sense, you know, it kind of upends your sense of intentionality. Suddenly, you're not really out to demonstrate a point, but you're out to be somewhat faithful to this complicated world that you've been running around in all these years.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Today, I'm talking to writer George Saunders about his new story collection, 10th of December. In saying that you're traveling in higher circles now, I've read that you said you can't really talk about writing, yet you've become a person for whom everybody wants to talk about writing to. And I mean, New York Times just the New York Times just called you, you know, a writer for our times. How do you balance that, and how do you deal with that demand as the popularity and demands on your time and expertise with the need to withdraw as a writer?
Well, I think you can talk about writing, but it's hard. It's hard to talk in a non-BS way about it. It's easy to talk reductively and say, oh, yes, you know, I meant to do that, or, you know, I had in mind that I would do blah, blah, blah. For me, that would be a false way of talking about it. So the trick is to kind of do what we're doing here, which is, you know, to kind of go into that gauzy territory where you're trying to describe something that's fundamentally mysterious. And I think mostly what I'm finding out is, you know, I like to be alone and I like to work. So if I can balance the public part of the job, the teaching and the, you know, the whatever else, it's just getting the mix right, really. You know, I think if a person ends up being public too much of the time, then they're just going to erode their talent, I think. So I've just, you know, it hasn't really been an issue up until this last few months, and suddenly I can see where you could easily, you know, end up spending a lot of time talking about it and not much time doing it. So then I think it's just self-discipline, you know, to say we're going to get the mix right and we're going to talk about it for one unit of time and do it for 20, and then it'll be all right.
I want to go back again and ask about a specific story in the collection, and I may pronounce this correctly, and forgive me if I do. But I think probably the most powerful story in this collection for me is the Semplica Girl Diaries. Will you talk about that, the genesis of that story and how it came to be and what that story means to you now?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is kind of an embarrassing answer, but I just dreamed it. I dreamed the central image of that story way back, like in 98, I think it was. And, you know, usually you dream something and you wake up and you go, oh, that's ridiculous. That's a terrible idea. But this one kind of stuck with me. So a couple days later, I just jotted down a couple thoughts about it. And then I think I just let it gestate for a week or two. And then, you know, the whole thing was how could I make a world in which that central image occurred naturally. And so I started just kind of, for some reason, I've been reading this book called I Will Bear Witness by Victor Klemperer, and it's an incredible diary of the Holocaust, and by a guy who lives in Dresden, and it's a real sneaky book because he doesn't know it's the Holocaust. You know, he just thinks it's a temporary disturbance. So it's somebody had written in a review that it's the one account of the Holocaust that feels like it's in color. you know. And so I thought, oh, that'd be interesting to try to tell this story in the diary form. So I just started, and it unfortunately, it took 12 years to get the whole thing finished. I had a lot of I blundered off the path a few times. I didn't realize it. And I guess for me, the main thing was to try to make it believable, to make it this really outrageous and kind of dark central image not seem like a contrivance, not seem like a clever thematic device or something, but make it seem like something that could actually happen. And what I found out was that combined with the diary is a deadly combination. And it just took just a ton of trying to get it where it felt both like a diary and felt sort of real, sort of naturalistic, if you will.
And not to leave our listeners in the dark, would you be willing to describe that central image of that story?
Yeah, sure. I dreamed that I got out of bed and walked to this window in our house. It actually doesn't exist, but the window in my dream looked out into the backyard. And in the backyard, there were these four women that I understood to be poor women from third world countries. And they were sort of like suspended in our yard with a wire that went right through their heads. So they were all four, like almost like paper dolls on a line. And they were wearing these long white smocks, and they all had long black hair, and they were perfectly happy to be there. They weren't hurt. They weren't in pain. They were just out there like long arms. And the weird part of the dream was that the person I was in the dream wasn't outraged or disgusted, but was just deeply content. Like, I remember thinking, the guy in the dream was thinking, oh, we finally made it. You know, finally I can give this wonderful thing to my kids. So it was a world in which those things were kind of a status symbol. So, that was like, to have that dream it's a little bit unnerving. But then, so I thought, okay, so that's interesting. And how did he get there? Like, how what kind of world is it where that could happen? So then it's just a 12-year journey of trying to sort of piece together that the logistics of that world. The thing that as I'm on this tour, I'm struggling to do is to be truthful about how the stories get written without being too clever about it, without being too reductive, because for me it really is about the iterations. Like if you write 400 drafts of something, all kinds of magical things can happen that you never could have predicted at the outset. My understanding of my job as a writer is to do the 400 drafts with a relatively kind of light touch and open mind, and then let the story kind of change under my hands until it gets sufficiently interesting. And that, in a way, that's kind of a hard thing to talk about. All of the things you said are totally valid, I think, and interesting, critically, provocative. But my conundrum is that if I had thought about those things too early, I would have jeopardized the story's health in a certain way. And the more sophisticated version, Einstein said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. So if you apply those to a story, it's just what you said. If you know what you're going to do at the outset, then the worst thing that could happen to you is that you could succeed. Because I think the reader then feels the condescension in that, right? Because you started out to do something, and it didn't really matter where the actual energy of the story was. It didn't matter what you were evoking in the reader. You were just dead set to get to your thing, And that is bound to leave the reader feeling a little bit miffed, I think, or bored, even worse.
I want to thank you not only for your time here, but also for our audience. I have a little story. I was at a panel at which you were speaking in, I believe, 2011 in New York, and there was a moratorium on approaching the authors after the panel. But I noticed that after everyone was done speaking, there were some folks getting autographs, and I had a copy of one of your books. But it appeared that the folks that you were talking to were family members, so I sort of decided to leave you alone, and I went into the lobby and used the restroom. And when I came out, you came over to me and said, "Hey, I noticed you waiting to get a book signed. Can I sign something for you?" And you were very, very gracious with your time then, and you have been very gracious and open with your time now. So I want to say very, very sincerely, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you I don't remember that, but I'm glad I did it. Maybe I thought you owed me some money or something.
I look like the kind of person that would owe people money, so it's absolutely an accurate read on your part.
No. Well, thank you for today. I enjoyed our talk very much.
Drew Adamek spoke with George Saunders in January. You can read Saunders' story, The Semplica Diaries, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, another great fiction writer, Jennifer Haig. She tells us about her new collection of Bakerton stories, News from Heaven. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jennifer Haig is one of my favorite contemporary writers of fiction. I think that's because, like Russell Banks, whose work I also love, she plumbs the rich vein of stories that lie within the lives of ordinary working people, those who've been so invisible for the most part in fiction, on television, and in the movies. Above all, these are the people who America once celebrated as the salt of the earth, but who were left in the dust as globalization sent jobs elsewhere in the proverbial giant sucking sound. Haig's 2005 novel, Baker Towers, introduced readers to her fictional town, Bakerton, Pennsylvania. Much like the town she grew up in, Bakerton was once a thriving coal mine community, but it slid into deepening poverty when the mines closed. But although the injuries of class inform Haig's writing, her stories are not dark, but rather, quote, uplifting and radiant, as a New York Times reviewer called them. They compel us with their profound compassion for their subjects and the unexpected moments of grace Haig coaxes from them. Readers came to love her characters, too, so much so that over the years they asked Haig what happened to them. Now she's come up with some of the answers in her new collection of stories about Bakerton, News from Heaven. In them, she weaves together the strands of her imagined community and its families over time. And in shining the spotlight on first one character and then another, Haig illuminates the various angles of the human soul. In addition to News from Heaven, Jennifer Haig is the author of four novels, including Baker Towers, Mrs. Kimball, Faith, and The Condition. Jennifer Haig, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
So in this collection of stories, News from Heaven, you return to Bakerton, Pennsylvania, which is the scene of a previous novel that we spoke to you about. It seems now a long time ago, must have been back in like 2004 or 5, and that is Baker Towers. Put us in Bakerton, Pennsylvania. Describe the scene, the setting in which these wonderful stories take place.
Well, Bakerton is a little company town in western Pennsylvania. It was once a coal mining town. And over the course of the 20th century, the stories show Bakerton falling on hard times, the coal mines faltering and then failing and then closing, and what happens to the town in their aftermath.
Yeah, you're talking about central Pennsylvania, a place where the coal mines have long been depleted, where deindustrialization has gone on, and you yourself know this region well.
Yes. I grew up in that part of Pennsylvania, in a little town that was once a mining town. And now, like a lot of the towns in that part of the state, is sort of bereft of any industry. So I am of the generation that had to move on and kind of find somewhere else to live because it is really a very difficult place to make a living today.
Now, these stories are chronological in scope. What's the span of time that they cover?
The first story opens in 1934, and the final stories in the collection are roughly contemporary.
Now, they start out with one of my favorite stories in the collection, if one could even choose, because I loved every one. It's called Beast and Bird, and it describes an outmigration from this area, an early outmigration that I had no idea ever happened. It's a story of Anna Lubicki, who is a Polish extraction, who comes to New York City and goes to work for a wealthy Jewish family. Talk more about this. How was this connection made between families in Bakerton, Pennsylvania, and New York City?
Well, Annie was sort of a desirable candidate for this job because she speaks Polish. And the family where she is employed is a polyglot family. They speak English, Polish, and Yiddish. So the mistress of the household likes the idea of having Polish-speaking help.
Tell us a little bit about Annie. What's she like?
Annie is quite naive, particularly as the story opens. She has never before been out of Bakerton. When we first meet her, she has never even ridden in a car. And at the beginning of the story, she lands in New York City. Her employer meets her at the train station and leads her into a taxi cab, which to her is an astonishing experience. When she arrives at the apartment, there is more astonishment in store for her because until that moment, she has never seen the inside of a kosher kitchen. And she is completely flummoxed by the fact of having two stoves and two sinks and two separate sets of dishes. For a girl like Annie, who grew up in a very poor family, having one complete set of dishes would have seemed like a luxury. There's a line in the story where she thinks of her mother's dishes, which are chipped and mismatched and sort of a cobbled together set.
She's completely flummoxed by this practice. In fact, she thinks his family must be crazy.
Well, in the absence of another explanation, she knows not the first thing about Judaism, and this has never been explained to her. So it's the only theory she can come up with.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful story. When I was preparing for this interview, I came across the New York Times review of this book, which was a good one, by the way. And I came across a quote from you in which you once said that you like to write about the ways that people behave when they think no one is looking. What did you mean by that?
Well, since I was a little kid, I've had a fantasy of being invisible. And as a novelist, you get to do that. You get to peer through people's keyholes and spy on them and eavesdrop on their dreams. And, I think it's one of the great freedoms of writing fiction.
Yeah, you're not just observing. You really get into the heart of your characters. I really felt that there was no judgment and just a real love of them. Could you talk a little bit about your process of character development?
Well, I would say I develop characters in the course of writing. Every day when I sit down to write, I at best we'll make one small discovery about who the characters are. Sometimes it's something very minor. But because I work every day and work consistently, over time, I sort of flesh out a more complete picture of who they are and their hopes and dreams.
And at least some of these characters are ones that you've been working with for quite a long time. Is that right?
Yes, it's true. It was one of the delightful surprises for me in writing this short story collection. When I finished writing my second novel, Baker Towers, in 2004, I really felt tapped out. I thought that I had said everything there was to say about that place and those characters. And it wasn't until a few years had passed that I realized that was perhaps not the case. And I started to play around with those characters a bit more. In the story collection, News from Heaven, you see a couple of characters from Baker Towers, Joyce Novak, the school teacher, and her younger brother, Sandy, who's sort of the prodigal son of the Novak family, who disappears for years at a time, and the family's never quite sure what's become of him. I bring Sandy back in these short stories, so readers of Baker Towers finally get the answers to all their questions about Sandy and what he really was up to in his life. There are also some minor characters from Baker Towers that I found myself still fascinated by. One is the schoolteacher Viola Peel, who gets her own story in News from Heaven.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that story.
Well, the story is called Something Sweet. It's the second story in the collection, and it takes place during World War II, although a portion of it is actually told in flashback to the years surrounding World War I. So it's Viola Peel as a school teacher looking out at her pupils, knowing that these boys will soon be drafted after they graduate, and thinking back to the boys of her own age who were drafted into World War I, and in particular, her two cousins, Edgar and Bronson Baker, of the Baker family for whom the coal mines and the town are named.
This was a very interesting and kind of disturbing story. For a long time, I didn't have a sense of the real relationship between these two boys. And I really don't want to give too much away, but one of them was quite unkind to Violet, I would say, brutal in fact. And then later we find out why that might have been. But it seemed as if there was also a bit of a class element here. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about class in the story and then about it also in the overarching scope of the book.
Well, I think class plays a role in everything I write. It's not always my intention going into the writing of a story, but I find that it's impossible to write about life as I see it, about people in any authentic way, without considering some of these questions. The character of Viola Peel is in an unusual situation in the town of Bakerton because her family is not dependent upon the mines for its livelihood. All her pupils are the children of coal miners. Viola herself sees herself as being quite separate from them because her father is a bookkeeper for the Baker Brothers mine, and also because she is distantly related to the Baker family. So you know, there is this sense of, you know, borrowed glory for Viola. Yet she isn't really a baker. She is not herself wealthy, but just by her association with them, she sets herself apart a bit from the rest of the town.
I'd like to go back to where you say that class is a part of everything, because I don't remember exactly what you said, but because you can't imagine writing about these characters without putting that in. Why do you feel that you can't explore a character without talking about class?
Well, I think class is sort of hard to get your hands around in American culture. You know, it's that we have long clung to this illusion that we are a classless society because we don't have titles, because there isn't such a thing as a noble class per se. And yet, you know, my view of the way people interact in American society is not entirely separate from class. Maybe in American terms, it has more to do with prosperity than some of the other signifiers of class. But I think that is, for me, that is always part of the story.
And it has, in the last couple of years, of course, become more a part of the conversation that we're having in America. I think you anticipated that. You are ahead of that in your work. In these stories, you're talking about so many of the things that are happening now across America. And I'm thinking now, jumping ahead to one of the later stories in the book, it's called What Remains, where you have one of the figures that's falling quite far. You have one of the bakers, Sunny Baker. And she stands in the way of the town's movers and shakers who want to build a prison. I mean, this was a wonderfully complicated story in the sense of the relationship between the new ruling class of the town and the ruling class that's going by.
Well, the reality is that in Bakerton, in the latter stories, there isn't a whole lot left to rule, really. The town has shrunk considerably. It's lost lots of population as the mines have shut down and families have moved away. So in that story, What Remains, you really are seeing the embers of the town. And that's what the title refers to, and it also refers to the main character, Sunny Baker, who kind of represents the embers of the Baker family. She is the last living baker. The mines have long since fallen down on their luck, and Sunny is still kicking around in town. And she has an odd sort of status in this town. She's actually a very lonely figure because she's separate from the town by virtue of being a baker, and yet all the baker wealth has left her. She's very much a solitary figure. So the conflict in the story has to do with the building of this prison. You know, in a certain way, working in a prison is one of the most difficult ways a person can make a living. In that way, it is like working in the coal mines. And yet, to the town councilors of Bakerton, the idea of having a prison built there seems like a great windfall. And this is the first new employer in the town of Bakerton in an entire generation. So they're really quite desperate to get the contract to build this prison.
Right, and it's not an uncommon story. I can think of very close to where this interview is being recorded in western Massachusetts, in the town of Ludlow, where a prison came in to supply employment. You know, as much as Amherst and some of the surrounding towns are enlivened by the existence of several colleges and universities, many of the towns in the area are very much like Bakerton, Pennsylvania, towns that have been deindustrialized, where poverty is endemic.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's very interesting, Francesca. One thing that has really fascinated me in the past few years as I've traveled around the country talking about Baker Towers is how universal this story appears to be. When I first wrote that novel and later these stories in News from Heaven, I sort of expected that they would be viewed as regional stories, you know, possibly of interest to people in the Rust Belt, but maybe not much of anywhere else. And after Baker Towers was published, I was pleased to discover that readers all over the country seemed to find something familiar in this experience. You know, people from logging towns in the Pacific Northwest look at Bakerton and say, I know these people, I know this way of life, this is the way I grew up. So it really is, it's a more universal story than it first appears to be.
We're talking with novelist Jennifer Haig about her newest collection of short stories. It's called News from Heaven. And News from Heaven, is there irony in this title?
No, that was not my intention, although I understand that reading of it. I think of these stories as elegies in a certain way. They're stories about a way of life that has disappeared or is in the process of disappearing, and in many cases, stories about characters who have since passed on. So really, you know, the idea of News from Heaven, it's almost like a dispatches from the beyond in a certain way.
Now, you are a coal miner's granddaughter, and as we said before, you came from a town much like Bakerton, Pennsylvania, and also like Bakerton, named for the owner of its coal mine, and you escaped, if one could use that word, and have become quite successful. Do you have family that still lives back in your hometown?
Yeah, I do.
And would you like to share what reaction do your family and the people that you grew up with have to your stories?
Well, there are two different answers to that. I think the reaction of my family has been somewhat different from the reaction of just people from the town. My family are all great readers. My mother was a librarian. My father was a teacher of English. You know, for my mother, having a daughter be a novelist is like having your son be the Pope. It's really just the best thing that could possibly happen. So she's keenly interested in everything I write. She is a voracious reader and a very thoughtful and discriminating one. So, in fact, I'm a bit nervous when I show her the things I've written. She really is one of the opinions I most value. In terms of the reaction of the town as a whole, I think by and large, there's been a real appreciation and a kind of gratitude for these stories, simply because this is a part of the world that is not used to seeing itself in print, is not used to seeing itself in the movies or on television. It's not like being from New York City. You know, there are very few images out there in the world of this way of life, and people in general seem delighted to be able to point to this and say, that is where I live, that is a way of life I recognize. I know that when I was growing up in that part of the world, I had a sense of being so peripheral, of being from a place that mattered so little, that nobody cared about. And, you know, I think for me at that time, it would have been very gratifying to see something written about my town, some acknowledgement that this place was there.
And you do tell the stories of these characters, as I said before, with such love and lack of judgment, and even when they themselves are confronting the judgments of others. One of the stories that I love is the story of Agnes. She ignores the judgment of her sister in order to find happiness. Could you tell us a little bit about this story?
Sure. The story is called Thrift, and it's one of the contemporary stories in the collection toward the end. The main character, Agnes Lubicki, who is a niece of Annie Lubicki, whom we've met in the first story, Beast and Bird. Agnes is, as the story opens, a spinster, if that word is still in use, a spinster of 50 years old, who has, up until this point in her life, always lived with her parents, always been sort of a hardworking, dutiful, good daughter, has never had a romantic relationship, has never taken a vacation. She's led a very kind of sheltered and hardworking life. And as the story opens, she, for the first time, finds herself falling in love with a man, a much younger man, who happens to be repairing her roof. And the story is really about the series of accommodations and allowances Agnes makes in order to help this relationship thrive and continue.
And yet it also seems, I mean, well, she makes allowances, but she also very much is not in the one down position, but puts herself in control of the situation.
In a certain way, she does. You know, Agnes is a woman who lives without illusions, and it's the thing I like best about her as a character. It is not a secret from her that her lover has some ulterior motives for being with her, and she's fine with that. She accepts that. It's worth it to her. She prefers her life with him to her life without him. So there's a real lucidity about her. I think she is sort of a subversive character in a lot of ways.
I'd like to go back to Sandy, actually, because, as you said, here are the answers of what happened to him. When you were writing Baker Towers, I mean, you said you were all tapped out after that. Did you have any inkling that he was going to end up the way he did in this story about him in this new collection, News from Heaven?
I did have a sense. I hadn't written a word of it, but it was all sort of in my head. And it came from knowing him deeply as the character I'd created. The challenge of writing Baker Towers was that the arc of the story was fairly tightly circumscribed. Going into it, I knew that I wanted to tell the story of the rise and fall of the coal mines. And so any tangent of story that falls outside that arc ended up not making its way into the finished book. Even at the time I knew there was more to say about all of these characters, I had made this commitment to telling this particular story about this sort of one movement in symphonic terms. It's sort of a movement in the life of this community. And so at the end of the day, I was left with a lot of loose ends, I suppose. And over the years, as I've met people who are very fond of the characters in Baker Towers, I cannot tell you how many times I have been asked questions about Sandy Novak. What was his story? What was he up to? What happened to him next? So at a certain point, I knew that I was going to have to write it.
And why do you think that's so? Why do you think people were so caught up in that?
He is a mysterious figure. He's charismatic, and he's also always on his way in or on his way out. He is really the Novak child who feels the least attachment to the town of Bakerton, who's most desperate to get away, who has a real sense of adventure, and he wants to get out and see the world and see what he can make of his life. And so he has a kind of independence that is not typical of the other Novaks. He's an unusual guy.
And it almost seems as if he does achieve that moment of greatness and sweetness at the very end. Well, Jennifer Haig, I just totally love this collection of stories in News from Heaven. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here again on Writer's Voice.
Wonderful. Thank you, Francesca.
In addition to News from Heaven, Jennifer Haig is the author of four novels, including Baker Towers, Mrs. Kimball, Faith, and The Condition. In addition to News from Heaven, Jennifer Haig is the author of Baker Towers, The Condition, and Faith. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interview with Haig about the novel Faith. We'll be right back. Yesterday, I heard morning birds for the first time this year, and I knew spring cannot be far behind. Here's a poem from Mary Oliver about one bird that I hope to see soon again. It's called Some Herons.
Some Herons. A blue preacher flew toward the swamp in slow motion. On the leafy banks, an old Chinese poet, hunched in the white gown of his wings, was waiting. The water was the kind of dark silk that has silver lines shot through it when it is touched by the wind, or is splashed upward in a small, quick flower by the life beneath it. The preacher made his difficult landing, his skirts up around his knees. The poet's eyes flared, just as a poet's eyes are said to do when the poet is awakened from the forest of meditation. It was summer. It was only a few moments past the sun's rising, which meant that the whole long, sweet day lay before them. They greeted each other, rumpling their gowns for an instant and then smoothing them. They entered the water, and instantly two more herons, equally as beautiful, joined them and stood just beneath them in the black, polished water, where they fished all day.
And that was Mary Oliver reading her poem, Some Herons. And right now, I want to tell you about a great opportunity to give a boost to our cultural heritage in the Pioneer Valley and help Writer's Voice. We have a grant from Mass Humanities for The River Runs Through Us, our special 6-part series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. We need to raise some funds to fulfill the conditions of our grant, and we've got a Kickstarter campaign to do it. So head on over to Kickstarter and search on The River Runs Through Us. Any amount of contribution is greatly appreciated. But we're not just asking for handouts. We have some wonderful rewards for your support, including new book titles and autographed books from local authors Susan Stinson and Jacqueline Sheehan. And check out the series at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.